From protest t-shirts to party wear, clothing has played an important role in Australia's rich queer culture. But who ensures that these stories are preserved, remembered, and celebrated? And where are the artifacts of this history kept? Hello, and welcome to the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Harriet Richards. I'm a lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University and co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined in the hosting hot seat by my colleague and Critical Fashion Studies co-founder, Natalia Lusty, Professor of Cultural Studies in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. Hi, Natalia.
Hi, Harriet. It's great to be back.
Yeah. Today, we're talking to Nick Henderson, curator at the Australian Queer Archives, about the collection's clothing and textiles. The collection is based at the Victorian Pride Centre in St Kilda and is a veritable treasure trove of art, books and ephemera that celebrate Australia's queer histories. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that this episode was recorded on the unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation. We pay our deep respect to First Nations elders past and present and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nick. So to begin with, can you tell us how the archives were established and what kind of purpose they serve in the broader community?
Thank you for having me. So the Australian Queer Archives is 45 years old. We were set up initially in Sydney in 1978 as an initiative of the Fourth National Homosexual Conference. So at the time, I guess activists had wanted to document the movement, as it was termed. It was basically 10 years old at that point. So broadly the political movement or the activist movement. But I guess very soon after, we really started expanding much more into documenting a much wider frame of material. So the material that we collect is really all aspects of Australian queer life and where it intersects with the wider community material culture. So even from the early years, that included textile material, activist t-shirts, but also a wider range of material that we've collected over time.
But I wonder too if it also stimulates new forms of activism and protest cultures when young people come into the archive and learn about this very rich history.
Look, absolutely. We have students coming in all the time. We have design students and academics. We have creatives coming in. You know, a lot of our material ends up getting shared in different spaces. So whether or not that's exhibitions, and that includes, for example, HIV/AIDS education and campaign t-shirts, which were recently in an exhibition in Adelaide at the David Roche Foundation looking at HIV/AIDS in fashion, through to material that's been recently on exhibition in Sydney at UNSW galleries around the party, which included outfits that look to celebrate individuals who passed from AIDS and others. So this, looking at that, the collection is inspiring the creation of your works being shared in different spaces. And for a lot of people who perhaps might not be familiar with some of those aspects like badges or the sorts of t-shirts and approaches to activism in the past, it's a great resource for them to access.
Yeah, awesome. I think, you know, the archives, just from what you're saying, they play such an important role, not only in preserving, but also celebrating these incredible histories of queerness in Australia. So kind of to set the scene, we thought we'd ask some questions about some of the key pieces in the collection. And of course, this is an audio medium, so maybe you can describe some of these items for our listeners as well. And of course, we'll put the images in our show notes. But we might start with an incredible punk leather jacket from Marcus Bunyan. And maybe you could describe the jacket and tell us about why it's so important.
Sure. So the jacket itself is quite a heavy, solid leather jacket. It was acquired in Melbourne by Marcus, who was a photographer. He was also a skinhead, a gay male skinhead who'd moved from London. He'd been involved in activism and in skinhead culture in England from basically mid-70s, from 75. He'd been involved in groups like a Campaign for Homosexual Equality. When he came to Melbourne, I guess, there wasn't the same skinhead or punk culture that he was familiar with that kind of stemmed from that British tradition. And so he really wanted to be visible and be present. And so he started making this leather jacket in the sense of customizing it. So the base leather jacket has quite a lot of material on it. It's got a lot of studs, which he put on in the front, the shoulders, on the epaulettes, down at the base of the back of the jacket. He collaborated with another artist who created the major back patch, but he also made patches himself, including one which has a pink triangle on the one of the sleeves. And on the front is a whole series of different badges, mostly enamel badges, which he's picked up from different spaces. So he often paired that leather jacket with a jumper, which he had found in, I guess, an op shop. And the jumper is really quite fascinating because when he found it, it had a swastika that was created out of safety pins on the back. And it was, you know, torn and tight, you know, kept together with safety pins. So for him, he saw that as an item which was likely created by Nazis or National Socialists. And so for him, kind of drawing on that and having the similar aesthetic, but being very much a gay man and a proud gay man and rejecting a lot of that politic, he customized that again and put a no in safety pins above that. So he often paired those two items together. So he was a very visible presence in that outfit, which very kind of clearly described everything that he wanted to present to the world in terms of his queerness and in terms of his fashion and community.
I love that in the archive's caption, it says, you know, it's his jacket from 1988 right through to 1993. So it's clearly, you know, a work in progress. And I remember seeing the jumper when I came down to the archives last year, and so many safety pins. It's amazing. Maybe we can ask a question a little bit later about preserving these items with all of these accoutrements attached to them.
Yeah, look, it is a really stunning jacket, and it is a complex jacket from a preservation perspective. Leather, particularly leather that's used in, I guess, in fashion, but also in BDSM and kink communities, often presents a whole lot of complexities because of their use. They have ingrained sweat and other things and are used in particularly heavy and demanding ways. And so keeping them in a condition that they can be continually accessed and used means, you know, the leather needs to be conditioned. Any of the metallic objects that might be pinned through, there needs to be really careful cleaning of those, coating of those to ensure that it's not going to damage the leather. And it needs to breathe in a way that some fabrics don't need to in an archive. So the sorts of microclimates that you store textiles in within an archive vary depending on the types of material that you're preserving.
Yeah, fascinating. I feel like Marcus really started a trend with the leather jacket and the kind of secondhand op shop knitted jumper that was held together by safety pins, because I think at one point that sort of exploded on the sort of queer neo-punk scene.
Absolutely.
So it's great to hear the backstory there. So the collection also houses a vast collection of T-shirts, and one that springs to mind is the one designed by Peter Tully, which I believe was designed specifically for the 1983 Mardi Gras, and there's images of Dennis Altman in one of those T-shirts. And just for the listeners, it was a kind of stylized face with opera house hair, inverted pink queer triangles, and in inverted harbour bridges the mouth. So beautiful design, and we know Peter Tully was the brains and creative genius behind the transformation of those Mardi Gras parades and the party from 1983 onwards when he became artistic director. But can you tell us a little bit about the history of that one object, that T-shirt, which is so iconic?
We've got a couple of versions of the T-shirt. It was a kind of a prominent item of merchandise that was being produced. And the logos and the imagery that Peter Tully used to create that. So it's a screen printed T-shirt. One of the versions that we've got, and you mentioned Dennis Altman. So we've got his T-shirt that he wore in that parade in 83, and he's cut off the arms. We've also got others that people have had. So, you know, often there is that customization, and that's part of a lot of the material that we've got in the collection as well, where people, you know, you can really see the use and the wear and tear that an item has had. And so that kind of really goes to the lived experience of a lot of these. So with this T-shirt, we've also got the original designs and the working drawings as well as the designs. And the design was also used in a whole lot of, I guess, objects that were carried, like placards essentially, but almost sculptural objects that were carried by people in the parade. And part of this moment in the early 1980s was Tully had been given a grant from the Craft Board of the Australia Council to set up a workshop in conjunction with Mardi Gras to really bring the kind of artistic element to those parades, create this kind of very visible public culture. So he was working on material floats that were produced by the workshop and also supporting the community in the creation of material for the parade, including costumes, clothing, you know, objects, floats, a whole range of material.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful history of that kind of move from that politicized moment to that really, you know, extravagant.
Well, you know,
float
in many ways it was always linked. And, you know, one of the things about the first Mardi Gras that people often say, you know, oh, look, it was a protest. And it was. But the first one in 1978 had been part of a whole day of events called the Day of International Gay Solidarity and inspired by and really prompted by a call from San Francisco. And they had issues that they were dealing with and they wanted international support. The evening event, which was the Mardi Gras, initially was framed, and if you look at the first poster, as a street festival, and people were invited to come along and dress up and be creative. So really that tension between the politics and the theatricality and the costuming was there really from the inception. Mm. And, you know, for somebody like Tully and many of his friends and social networks, they were artists and activists, and they combined the two seamlessly really in their work. From the gay liberation period, people like David McDermott, who was Tully's very good friend, former lover and long-term, you know, friend and collaborator, to create that sort of community, which was both creative and political.
And so you also have in the collection some incredible costumes and pieces from events. And one of those is the Miss Peninsula sash, which I think is maybe one of the oldest textile pieces you have in the collection.
It would be right. We do have other material from the 60s, and it's possible some from the 50s. Some of the drag outfits that we have, we aren't always able to very clearly document the first time things were used. And a lot of these are custom in a sense. So most of these were made by friends and often people involved in the theatre. So the sash, it's a beautiful pink or salmon sash. And it's got a whole series of years and names that are written along the sash. And essentially, what it documents is a yearly event that was held from the early to mid-1960s, really for the next 30 to 40 years. And basically, it was a group of friends who would get together, hire a number of houses down on the Mornington Peninsula, and really have a whole series of events over the course of the Queen's Birthday weekend, which has long been a very significant weekend and holiday for the camp and queer and gay communities. So over that, they had various competitions, and the final, the peak of the weekend was Miss Peninsula. And so that was awarded. And so these would be mixed drag and regular clothing, but a lot of people would dress up. And it was an opportunity to kind of come together, you know, be silly, celebrate with friends, and kind of build that sort of social network and community that wasn't always able to be presented in public spaces in the city.
Yeah, I mean, you've actually got the sash itself, but also some really beautiful photographs of people wearing it as well.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I think about archives in that perhaps differentiates us in some ways from galleries and museums is that some of these items sit within a whole network of materials. So, you know, in addition to the sash, we have a very large collection from someone who won it a couple of times, Lottie, Robert Albert Lott. We have 2,500 photos documenting his life from the late 1940s to the early 2000s, as well as costumes, costume jewellery. And we also have oral history interviews that support this. So there's a whole range of material. And, you know, often there's this sense, I think, with queer material culture that because mainstream institutions haven't necessarily profiled or privileged that material, that either doesn't exist or it's not important. Mm. And part of that, I guess, approach for the archives, the queer archives, is to ensure that this material is kept and preserved.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And when you go into that space, you very much get that sense of a very rich kind of political and social and cultural history coming to life. And I guess when we visited the other night, I was really taken with the collection of buttons and badges that you have on display in one of the vitrines there. And in looking through all the buttons, you know, the kind of huge range from ones that often suggest coalition with other kind of activist movements, whether it's environmentalism or anti-nuclear movements. You've got sort of regional variations like, you know, Pride kind of badge. And then a real sense of humour comes through in a lot of them. And I guess one of my favourites was the Avenge Oscar Wilde badge.
It's a favourite, absolutely, with its little green carnation.
Yeah.
I think one of my favourites is Land Rights for Gay Whales, which has been used a couple of times, or the Cover Me in Honey and Throw Me to the Lesbians. You know, there's some really great ones. And I think often for people wearing them prominently, you know, it's an opportunity to break the ice, to present people with an object, an image that they can read, engage, smile, and, you know, something that might be a little bit more confronting to people in terms of being visible, you know, buffing off that rough edge a bit.
Yeah. Another one I love is the badge that dare not speak its name, which is, you know, a nice little kind of riff on that well-known phrase. But it does, you know, more seriously, I guess it also documents the really kind of subversive humour, the irony and satire to really cut across some of the kind of entrenched homophobia that queer people encounter in life and a way in which to, you know, restate what is meaningful for queer life and politics.
And a lot of that, I think, you know, you can look at people like Pauline Pantsdown and others who use clothing, use fashion, use playing with gender, obviously, with a, you know, drag persona to really try to undercut that, the serious parody that enables somebody to kind of really show that hypocrisy and really bring it up. And, you know, obviously that's a very current issue, looking at things like drag queen story time and the sorts of activism that's happening now, and the role and responsibility that queer people have, and their way that their fashion may appear confronting to people who don't understand that in different spaces. That, you know, if it had been Dame Edna, that seems it could have been fine with a lot of people. But, you know, all those various aspects that really confront people.
And a nice reminder as well of the power of clothes and their kind of enduring capacity to provoke as well as to make us feel comfortable or at home.
And part of community.
You know, I think one of the things. Solidarity.
Very much so. You know, even with less visible clothing in the sense of overt slogans that might be on protest t-shirts, educational t-shirts or badges, I think, you know, for a lot of queer people, as in previous years, you know, clothing was that signifier. It could have been the suede shoes. It could be the, you know, apocryphal stories of the yellow socks in Newcastle or, you know, the green carnation and other things. And often it is in different spaces, it makes people feel connection to a community and feel safety in different ways.
I also was wondering, and you've touched on this a little bit, but maybe if you could tell us a little bit more about the process of archiving these materials and what else is required to ensure that these garments are preserved so that we can continue telling these stories.
Sure. It really depends on the type of material. And so generally at the outset, it is documenting the context of the item, the creator, or, you know, often it is, particularly these days, I mean, we have 1,100 t-shirts in the collection. And increasingly, a lot of those are what I would say might fit more into the corporate pride side of things. So we actively collect material being produced and displayed in spaces that might be, say, Fair Day up in Sydney, Mardi Gras, Pride March down here, or from around Australia. And so often, you know, you've got businesses, community groups who are celebrating that part of their business, you know, in terms of making their space inclusive. So with those, often we do get a kind of fresh out of the packet sort of t-shirt. So for us with that, it's really documenting that context where it was received, provenance, which is always key. We also kind of document aspects of copyright for a lot of that material. If it's more unique, and often we get material that might be, you know, one-offs produced for events or by artists. So we've got material from, say, David McDermott in terms of painted t-shirts and jumpers. And so in that, we're also getting into copyright, but also moral rights, how people want material to be presented. And we're conscious that the material exists both in its period of time, but has shifted through time in different ways. So it's documenting that aspect. And then in terms of the item itself, we'll go through cataloguing, photographing, and then rehousing. So with something like a t-shirt, it's using things like acid-free paper to support folds. I would love to have things that could be laid flat or a space that was large enough to hang a lot of material. But 1,100 t-shirts takes up quite a bit of space. So, yeah, look, it's a whole range of processes with that. And the more unique an item is and the more complex its needs will kind of necessitate different approaches to that material. But increasingly, the material is being used a lot for exhibition, which is really fantastic to see material getting out, active, used, and whether it's by researchers or for an exhibition. So, you know, we need to have a lot of that information ready to go.
Which is perfect to move on to our next question, which is about your involvement in the curation of the amazing The Party exhibition at UNSW Galleries in Sydney as part of World Pride. As you mentioned, a lot of material is often loaned out to various exhibitions, and so some of that material may have been on display before. But I think what that exhibition did was give us this extraordinary look into this sort of rich world of party life in that period from, you know, the 70s through to the early 2000s, and really showing both the kind of spirited way in which designers and lay people came together to collaborate, but also, you know, the way in which so much of that period got documented and obviously then kind of moved to somewhere like the Queer Archives. So could you just tell us a little bit about how you went about selecting material for that exhibition? Because I can imagine that it would have been very difficult.
Look, it was very overwhelming. And I should say at the outset that I co-curated that exhibition with the wonderful Jose da Silva, who's director of UNSW Galleries. We had previously worked a little bit together. We'd lent material to a previous exhibition called Friendship as a Way of Life, looking at kinship in queer communities. So through that, I guess we developed a working relationship and saw an opportunity with Sydney World Pride to develop an exhibition that could really celebrate localized queer community, and particularly looking at party culture. It's not really an area which has been celebrated a great deal, and particularly in the way that we wanted to have the exhibition. So there is some wonderful material at the Powerhouse, and they previously exhibited that as part of an exhibition on the 1980s. But for us, we wanted to kind of look at a longer trajectory. And so the kind of jumping off point, we wanted to really highlight the role and importance of parties in queer communities and the role of the queer community in pioneering party culture. And really, it was the queer community that built warehouse parties in its outset and really kept on pioneering and pushing that envelope. So when we started looking at that history, it was really kind of digging in, getting a real sense of what that might look like from a geographical perspective, looking at the sorts of material. A lot of the material is material that I'd collected for the Queer Archives over the past 15 years. And so I had a sense of that material and a sense of the individuals that had produced the material, created these parties. And so really, we just started creating this kind of visual timeline. You know, I'd be dumping stuff into Dropbox and Jose would be doing the same. We're kind of looking at our connections, looking online. There's some really fantastic Facebook groups. I guess it is an older social medium in some ways, but it is a wonderful space for a lot of older people to connect over material in their archive, their own personal collections. So it was really kind of looking at all those different sources, pulling all of that together and looking at the sort of story that we could tell in the space. Essentially, the focus, we had to cut it off at one point. So we decided 2002, which was really when there was a whole lot of crackdown on parties, which led to some of these big parties stopping at the showgrounds up in Sydney. And we wanted to kind of provide the context that led into the creation of those parties. So we put a couple of spaces looking at parties in the 1970s and also looking at some of the venues to talk about all those different threads. So look, it was very tricky narrowing the material down and getting a sense of the different threads that we wanted to tell. And obviously a lot was missed out, but we think we did reasonable justice to the material. Oh,
absolutely. And I just want to, obviously fashion and wearables and costumes played a big part in that exhibition. So I just want to focus on a few pieces. And these are the waistcoats and other kind of costumes designed by Mark O'Brien, who I don't know of, and I'm going to ask you about Mark O'Brien, because I found these absolutely stunning in terms of their use of everyday kind of found materials. So one of them is the beautiful AstroTurf Fighting for Our Lives waistcoat, which is from 1985, and also the extraordinary collage piece Icon outfit from almost a decade later in 1997 to 1998. And that in particular has this amazing kind of collage of iconography from Tom of Finland and Hindu kind of works sandwiched in between clear plastic to create this wonderful effect. And then there's the cockroach masks from the 90s as well. Just extraordinary creativity, and the fact that this person is producing these costumes over a decade means that this person was obviously involved in party culture for that long. So
absolutely.
Can you tell us a bit about Mark O'Brien and their amazing kind of outfits?
So Mark was a very active party goer in Sydney. And look, there was a very significant party culture in the sense that it was, for some people, really their main expression of community. You know, during the late 1980s, spaces like the Horden Pavilion were essentially putting on massive dance parties by a number of different party crews, a number of gay party crews, and marketed very much into the community. And so you really had this kind of constant big, major party spaces. And these spaces would also be very creative. They'd have designers creating backdrops and objects and lighting designers that really engaged a lot of aspects of community, as well as performance, drag performance, community performance, and others. So really, it's an incredibly creative space. And for a lot of partygoers, they also really wanted to match that, you know, particularly for the big parties of the year, like Mardi Gras and Sleaze, and increasingly later on for parties like Sweatbox and others. But Mardi Gras and Sleaze were kind of two really significant moments in the beginning and later part of the year where people were really inspired to dress up. They had costume awards. And so Mark was one of those creatives, really producing some really interesting material. He had, some of the forms like the vest, which he repeated, and that was, you know, did enable him to dance and move in a way that was much more, you know, in alignment with the music. And, you know, they started being able to express different things. You know, one of those vests celebrated the death, celebrated the life of a good friend of his who'd passed away from AIDS. You know, it was a way for him to honour him on the dance floor. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're also talking about people who are being honoured by their ashes being spread and danced into the dance floor, mm-hmm. mixed with glitter or spread on the way on the Mardi Gras parade on the way up Oxford Street. So these spaces were memorial spaces, celebratory spaces. For Mark, though, I guess coming into the 90s, what he saw was this increasing commercialization and mainstreaming of the Mardi Gras parties. He didn't see that it was kind of reflective of the sorts of music and space that he wanted to be in. So he started creating his own parties with friends, Lance Cunningham and others. And as part of that, they were doing parties, Sodom Circus, Sodom Gomera, a whole range of parties that he put on. And that really pushed his aesthetic and his creative focus, I guess, more into a more theatrical, slightly horror-inflected series of outfits, often using more rubber. There's three outfits that are in the exhibition that he created and wore. And one is that sort of cockroach rubber sort of alien headpiece with tubes. There's another which is almost, it's like a resin, dyed resin pregnant belly, but yeah, with toys, and used to also have lights and had Amel bottles and various things as part of this outfit. And so for him, you know, it was pushing that along with his friends who were putting on these parties and creating the more radical parties that were also a counter space to some of the more mainstream parties of that time.
And I think just as we come to the end of this amazing conversation, you've mentioned to us that part of doing this exhibition has also meant that you've received new acquisitions for the archives. And so just thinking forward to the future of the archives, what's coming up next? Can you give us any, you know,
highlights
of some of those acquisitions that you've received post the party exhibition?
Sure. Well, look, the Mark O'Brien outfits are ones that have come to us.
Amazing.
And that's really exciting. And I think there's a great opportunity to look at that material in more depth. I've been quite conscious that a lot of the material that has survived has focused more on the men's experience. And so for us, it's also looking at women's material. I guess moving forward in terms of future projects that we're working on, we've got different exhibitions. We've got one at the moment on at the Victorian Pride Centre, which is on Wicked Women photographs, and Wicked Women, which was the first lesbian sex magazine. It was produced in Australia, based out of Sydney, but from late 1987 through to 95. And there was also leather and performance outfits as part of that. So for us, we're quite keen to look at those areas and also look at some more of the everyday fashion. I've tried to get a lovely 1970s lesbian overalls at some point. If anybody out there has some, that would
call
be great.
Out, please. Yeah, get exactly. In touch.
Absolutely. And look, I think that we're also looking at aspects like marriages, and both marriages historically, camp marriages that were performed, but right through to legal marriages. Lots of different material
that we're collecting.
So if you're out there and you've got material, please get in touch.
Thank you again so much, Nick, for joining us today. Thank you also to Natalia for joining me as co-host for this episode. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in finding out more about the collection at the Archives, you can visit the Australian Queer Archives website, follow them on Facebook, or arrange a visit in person at the Victorian Pride Centre. We'll include all the links in our show notes. If you're loving this season of the Critical Fashion Studies podcast, I invite you to join us for the next episode, when I'll be talking to designer Emily Nolan about made-to-measure tailoring for diverse bodies. I also encourage you to subscribe to the series in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. As ever, a big thank you to Creative Victoria for their generous support, Thomas Phillips for audio engineering and co-production, Sanam Goodman for social media expertise, and Hugh Caldwell-Ross for our logo. See you next time!